Madam Clerk, do we have an easel of some sort? I think there's an exhibit that's going to be used. Do we have one?
Not that I'm aware of.
Well, when you finally get to that point, you can hold it up there as long as you want us to see it, and then put it back down. All right. You may proceed.
Thank you, and good afternoon, and may it please the court, I'm Brian Casey, here for Emerald Point LLC and the Breeding Company. I would like to reserve about 2 minutes for rebuttal. This is a case...
Is that 2 minutes or about 2 minutes?
About 2 minutes.
About?
Okay, about.
All right, well, I'll follow that carefully.
This is a case where four plaintiffs were tenants in an apartment complex in Virginia Beach, and they were exposed to carbon monoxide leaks on two separate occasions, approximately a little bit more than a month apart. On each of those occasions, the leaks were promptly detected and repaired. There are six assignments of error on this appeal, and I doubt I will get to all of them, and obviously we'll rely on the briefs. The first assignment of error has to do with the trial court's error in permitting Dr. Alan Lieberman, a medical expert for the plaintiffs, to offer testimony and opinions about opinions and factual testimony that were not disclosed in the plaintiff's expert witness designation or in Dr. Lieberman's medical records. And I'll talk a little bit about some of those instances. The rest are discussed in our brief, but I want to highlight a few of them. Dr. Lieberman saw one of the plaintiffs, Lindsay Hawkins, on October 27, 2014, about 10 months after the second carbon monoxide exposure, and he did not see the other three plaintiffs. He testified at trial. His testimony was played by deposition, but he testified that dementia is a long-term effect of exposure to carbon monoxide, and that a much higher percentage of people who are exposed to carbon monoxide develop dementia later in life. And plaintiff's counsel then took that testimony and argued to the jury that the plaintiffs in this case were at a high risk of developing dementia later in life. The reason that's important is because testimony about dementia and opinions about dementia and the relationship between it and carbon monoxide and the risk of developing it later in life were not disclosed in the expert witness disclosure for Dr. Lieberman. He also testified that 56,000 people die as a result of exposure to carbon monoxide, and the relationship between carbon monoxide and death is not something that was disclosed prior to trial in accordance with Rule 4:1b, the expert witness disclosure. He also testified about a study that he was familiar with, a study of Japanese coal miners, that found that 59% of Japanese coal miners in this study had headaches 33 years after their initial exposure to carbon monoxide. And that study of coal miners and that opinion about the relationship between carbon monoxide and headaches well past the time of initial exposure was not disclosed in the expert witness designation.
Now, the disclosure said that he would testify about memory deprivation and cognitive deficits.
Yes. The disclosure lists...
Isn't that broad enough to cover dementia?
Well, it lists a number of symptoms, including what you mentioned, memory impairment, but it doesn't say that a much higher percentage of people who are exposed to carbon monoxide will develop dementia later in life. And it doesn't give a summary of the grounds for such an opinion. So while it lists, and I think it lists about 33 symptoms or 32 symptoms of that he will testify about, it doesn't give any more information about those symptoms than just a list.
Let me ask you as a practical matter, did you take his deposition?
His deposition was taken by trial counsel and by both trial counsel on May 6th, which would have been 10 days before trial started. And that deposition was taken and then used and played audiovisually in front of the jury.
May I ask you a threshold question on that? Your opposing counsel argues that while you objected, or you noted an objection to the final order, as the trial was unfolding, you only had one objection, and the court struck most of that answer. And so his argument is you waived that issue. Can you help us with that point?
Absolutely. What happened was that, as I mentioned, that the deposition testimony of Dr. Lieberman was taken 10 days before trial began. The deposition transcript was prepared. A hearing was noticed by plaintiff's counsel to rule on the objections to Dr. Lieberman's testimony. Actually, the notice of the hearing was prepared and filed before the deposition was even taken, because it was anticipated that there would be objections in the deposition that needed to be ruled on by the court. And so that hearing was then set on Friday, May 13, 2016, the Friday before the trial began on the following Monday. At that hearing, which was noticed by plaintiff's counsel, there were numerous objections that were made to various parts of the deposition testimony of Dr. Lieberman. And the trial court ruled on those objections, and then subsequent to that, an order was prepared memorializing the trial court's rulings on those objections. The order was prepared, and it included excerpts of the deposition attached to the order as an exhibit, excerpts of Dr. Lieberman's deposition, so that the order referenced the transcript pages and line numbers of the deposition testimony of Dr. Lieberman for each of the objections that were made. In other words, the order says what part of the testimony was objected to by reference to page and line number of the attached exhibit, gives the basis for the objection, and in our ones that we assign error to, the basis is that the testimony was outside of the scope of the designated expert designation, and then it gives the trial court's ruling on those objections.
So this is the way this unfolded is a little different than your typical, the witness gets up to testify at trial. You kind of had that
exactly. Because
of the dynamic, different mode of preserving that objection.
Exactly. That's how that was done. And then the testimony was played at trial. It was a videographer who edited as best they could. They didn't quite get it all correct, but edited as best they could the audiovisual part of the deposition based on the ruling of the trial court on the Friday before trial. The deposition was then played at trial, and that transcript is in the trial transcript. And then that order, just to finish the point, the order itself was not signed by the trial judge until after the trial was over, because the ruling happened on a Friday, the trial began on a Monday, and by the time they got the order prepared and signed by both counsel and presented to the trial judge, the verdict had already come in.
Thank you.
May I ask you this? In the DeBeniesi deposition that was used at trial, the doctor said that the exposure was chronic, his words, and that, in his opinion, it probably began before November.
Right, and that's an important point, because
a huge point if it began before the incidents in this case.
Exactly, and that was a very prejudicial point, because he made a contrast between a chronic low dose exposure to carbon monoxide and contrasted that with an acute transient high dose. And in his opinion, again, none of this is disclosed, but his opinion was that a chronic low-dose long-term exposure was much worse health-wise than an acute transient high-dose exposure.
So is there anything in the disclosure that even touches upon the possibility that the doctor's opinion was that this toxicity occurred sometime probably before November?
No, there isn't.
And so if there was nothing else in this case but that, wouldn't that be a reason to hold that the expert should not have been allowed to testify?
Absolutely, because he testified that the exposure probably began when the furnace first came on in the fall of 2012. There's nothing in the expert designation that indicates that he has an opinion that the exposure began in the fall of 2012 when the furnace first came on. And that's what he testified to, before November. He said it was probably before November, and it probably was when the furnace first came on for that season. And then he, so he...
Can I interrupt you again? In the order that the trial court entered, where he went through every one of your objections, and the objections are specific, including beyond the scope of the designation, is that one point, the timing of the chronic exposure and when it began, part of the court's order where he identifies, like, I'm overruling this as beyond the scope of the disclosure?
Yeah, I believe that's at appendix page... The testimony is at appendix page 957, I believe, and I believe that paragraphs 13 and 14 at appendix page 20 are the parts of the record that speak specifically to that. If I may be off a page or two because the order is lengthy.
So you're a couple days ahead of trial, and you have an expert saying something about the chronic nature of the exposure and the timing that was never once mentioned ever before up to that point.
Never once mentioned, because the defense went into this case with an idea that because that's what the evidence or the discovery showed, was that there were two separate independent exposures, one on November 26, 27, 2012, a second one on January 4, 2013. Both were discovered promptly. Both were repaired promptly. Testing of carbon monoxide levels after the repairs showed that there was no further problem. The leaks were resolved. And so we had these two exposures. The defendants were responding to these two separate exposures. And then the plaintiff's expert, Dr. Lieberman, comes in and throws that all the way upside
down.
Before
you run out of time, supposing you're right on that, supposing the trial court abused its discretion by not enforcing the discovery rules and allowing undisclosed opinions to be said at trial, what does that do to the other 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 assignments of error?
Well, if that's the basis for reversal, some of the other assignments of error still need to be addressed, I would submit. The second assignment of error has to do with the granting of the adverse inference instruction. And the adverse inference instruction was granted as a sanction for spoliation of the furnace. And our view, obviously, is that that was error for the trial court to do that because, one, there was no duty on the part of the defendants to preserve the furnace to begin with. And secondly, even if a duty had been imposed on the defendants to preserve the furnace, an adverse inference instruction was not the proper remedy because there was no intentional deprivation.
Let me, if I may, flip the last question. Supposing you're right on that, that the court used the wrong legal standard for spoliation, and if they'd used the right legal standard, it could be a completely different answer in this case.
Correct.
What would that do to your first assignment of error? Would it moot that, or would it the first assignment of error be resolved in your favor, hypothetically, and that govern the second retrial?
If the trial court reverses on the adverse inference instruction solely, or reverses on the, I'm sorry, if this court reverses on the adverse inference instruction, then on retrial in the trial court needs to know whether Dr. Lieberman's testimony can come in or not.
Why couldn't it come in if it's a complete redo?
It still hasn't been disclosed under the rule.
But could the trial court allow a
yes,
supplement?
Exactly. The trial court could allow a supplement and allow that testimony to be disclosed in a supplemental expert witness interrogatory answer.
Well, counsel, in that regard, could not the court also permit the change in the addendum?
That's correct. I think if the change in the addendum issue becomes moot upon a reversal.
So they can ask whatever they want.
They can ask whatever, exactly. There's no more prejudice on the addendum issue if this case is remanded for a new trial. There still is the motion to drop issue, and I don't think that's mooted, the motion to drop the misjoined parties. And I will reserve my remaining time, please.
You have almost 1 minute, 41 seconds. Are you helping with an easel? All right, bring it up. Thank you. And, of course, your opposing counsel has seen it. Is that correct? Counsel, have you seen this exhibit?
Mr. Halloran showed it to me at the recess today.
Okay.
So I have seen it. I know it's not part of the record.
Well, I my understanding is it's in aid of his argument and somewhat like a flow chart of some sort. All right, go ahead.
Good If it pleases the court, I'm Ed Halloran for the appellees, and I was trial counsel in the trial court. An explanation of what occurred here, I think, is in order. What we're dealing with is a quadplex. This outside is the roof line, the end of the building, and an attic, and a shingled roof. We have four units. The plaintiff's unit was 2163, 2157 was next door, the unit below, and the unit below the one next door. Each of these units had a fire, a furnace, a gas furnace. Furnace below the plaintiff's furnace, the plaintiff's below the next door, and below that. Each of one was vented with a vent pipe for the CO2 and the byproducts of combustion to go out through the roof. This line is a cut in the roof where the flue pipe goes out. The bottom furnace connected with a T to the top furnace.
Counsel, may I interrupt you for a second? Did the trial court use the proper legal standard for the adverse inference under the spoliation doctrine?
Yes.
And how could it be true if there's no intentionality at all, either intentional decision by a party to secrete evidence or destroy it, or knowledge that the particular thing that you're allegedly secreting or destroying is really the subject of any real claim? And in this case, there was an examination of what you're showing us now, and no one asked to see the old furnace while it was then present and available. No one asked for it.
The short answer, Justice Kelsey, is in the largely in the amicus brief that's filed, that the law in Virginia does not require bad faith, and under the circumstances of the case, and I'll get to the evidence of the heat exchanger being burned out, if I can indulge in continuing.
Doesn't it require intentionality?
No.
So you can negligently lose evidence and be hit with an adverse liability inference in a civil trial.
Intentionality to discard the furnace, but not in, intentionality to conceal evidence in the sense of bad faith.
And you think that's the law of Virginia? That you can not have any intentionality on the effort to keep evidence from a threatened or foreseeable claim that could be filed against you and yet be hit with an adverse inference on spoliation? Is that the law anywhere, actually?
Well, the majority is that if it's disposed of and it's evidence that is known by the defense to be relevant and helpful, and it's within the discretion of the trial court to decide whether you get a permissible inference, a rebuttable inference, or depending on the facts of the case. In this particular case, I've been giving marching orders not to argue if bad faith occurred, but if we go through what actually occurred, I think the trial court could have found bad faith in this case.
March on.
Well, when did you ever ask to inspect the furnace? Did you ever ask to inspect it? It was in the storage area.
When it was missing, the assumption that was made that it had been discarded, that they'd replaced the furnace. And there was the assumption was made there was no reason.
Did you learn it was missing?
During the course of discovery, what we did is we.
So it was after trials, after you filed your suit.
It's approximately the time we filed the suit. The sequence that occurred is the furnace was taken out. It was taken out for and held for almost a year and a half. While it was being held. The only people that knew that they had it were the defendants, and the folks that carried it out. It was a good furnace, the testimony was, with nothing damaged on it. They were placed on notice. It was a notice of representation. The insurance company took the statements of the individuals. The insurance company took photos of the furnace. It had all the information on it. It would have said how old it was and so forth. It was relevant. We were claiming the crack heat exchanger. They had four notations in their work orders. It was a cracked heat exchanger.
Did your experts ever request to see the old furnace?
They did not because they assumed that it had been discarded.
But it hadn't been discarded. They made a faulty assumption.
It was in the after litigation. It was inquired into, and of course, by then it was gone.
Now, what if it had been discarded immediately? What if people who carried it out took it straight to the landfill? Would that have been spoliation?
The case would vary depending on the facts.
Now, let's take these facts and change one. That is, the people who carry it out take it directly to the landfill. Would that have been spoliation?
Depending what they knew. In this particular case, the people who would have taken it to the landfill would have been advised by Virginia Natural Gas that there was a suspected heat exchanger. They would have recorded that four different times. They would have looked at it and not examined it in the proper fashion by taking it all apart. And yes, with the month knowledge they had from the first time the alarm went off until the second time the alarm went off, they were advised four times by their own management
that it was defective, that it was faulty in some fashion.
A cracked heat exchanger. They wrote down. It's in their
records. Okay. So I'm an installer, or in this case a disinstaller, and I see a work order that says cracked heat exchanger, switch out the furnace. And then when I take out the old one, I say to myself, I must keep this because it might be spoliation. Is that the standard?
It would depend on the circumstances.
I'm giving you your circumstances with one fact changed, and just one.
That if they threw it out immediately,
yeah.
I think in this case it would be if management knew and was dealing with a cracked heat exchanger or eliminating it and knew there might be litigation, as was stated in their own records. We've got to cover our tracks because this may end up in court. And knowing what they knew from Virginia Natural Gas and in their own records, I would say yes, because they had a month of knowledge of the issue of the cracked heat exchanger.
And then, okay, so now that I'm saving this large piece of equipment that will never be used again, when am I allowed to discard it?
Under the circumstances of this case, when the insurance company got involved, you'd want to keep it, I would think, until the insurance company got involved. And
your own insurance company?
I would think so.
Would that would be the difference between spoliation and non-spoliation, the involvement of your own insurance company? It's not the answer I was expecting.
Our position under the facts of this case is, knowing what they knew about the heat exchanger and the likelihood of litigation, it was not appropriate for them to discard the furnace.
So,
especially when the evidence was, their position was, there was nothing wrong with it, but they knew our allegation was that there was something wrong with the heat exchanger.
Who made the decision to discard the furnace? Did Emerald Point LLC make that decision, or any officer, or any lawyer, or any claims adjuster, or any insurance rep?
The evidence tended, you could infer from the evidence, they knew litigation was coming. They took pictures of it, and the pictures disappeared also.
But the
testimony was that the workers from the complex just decided to throw it out after it had been kept for a year.
Right. Assume, just for the sake of argument, no concession, that that's true. A bunch of guys in the warehouse said, what is this thing sitting around here for so long? Toss it. Could that ever, under any scenario, be spoliation? It's at best negligence. And the workers obviously know nothing about, you know, whether your expert wants the thing safe or not.
Under the majority of the opinions, it could be spoliation.
Your position has to be that once they have notice of the lawsuit and they have notice that this is a relevant and highly relevant aspect of the lawsuit, it's incumbent on management to take steps to make sure the low-level workers who might just be encumbered by this thing understand we can't toss them.
Exactly, especially with their insurance carrier involved and photoing it and with all the memos they're sending out.
Right, but look at the timing. I mean, I understand the evidence is undisputed that on both November 27th, 2012, January 4th, 2013, the defendants determined that the cause of the leak was a dislocated flue pipe, indeed two different flue pipes. Nobody investigating either incident, BNG, Virginia Beach Code Enforcement, Emerald Point's maintenance team, determined that there was any defect in the furnace itself. Is that not true? Or
that
is it
not true, and if I can explain what the evidence showed, I'll explain why with the diagram here.
Okay.
The furnace that they had a heat exchanger. The fire was underneath the heat exchanger. It was supposed to go out and move. On the move in September 2012, we weren't using the furnace as it got cold. They all testified on the discovery. They said so. They began to use the furnace in October. The plaintiffs all testified, and the records show, and the history and the discovery show that their symptoms, they began to feel symptoms but not get really sick until they've been in there long. The heat exchanger, when Vassnight showed up from Virginia Natural Gas, he found 37 parts per million at the furnace in the closet. Later in the day, Calvin Morris of the defendants found 3 parts per million of CO coming out the vent. The experts in the case testified that the only way for this.
What was the date of that?
This was on November 27, 2012. We find carbon monoxide at the furnace coming out this vent.
Okay, well, who were the inspectors at that point?
Mr. Bassnight inspected. He testified that he is taught that when you get a reading like this, you go to the furnace and you measure the CO at the furnace, and it's coming from likely two sources, either a cracked heat exchanger or something plugged in the flue pipe.
Right, but didn't Danny Carlson of Code Enforcement confirm that the repair to the flue pipe on that same day solved the problem?
If I can explain.
Well, can you answer my question, though, before you explain, please? I mean, did Danny Carlson of Code Enforcement confirm that the repair to the flue pipe on November 27, 2012 solved the problem and that the apartment was safe for the occupants?
He relied on this Calvin Morris's representation that this problem was fixed, and it wasn't.
Okay. So he did say it was fixed?
Yes, code enforcement did.
Okay.
So after the, Bassnight testifies that it's either a cracked heat exchanger or it's a block in the flue pipe, and the complex is advised and they're notified with a red tag, get a competent repair person in to check before you put this back in service. And, of course, the complex is not an unqualified man. Calvin Morris is into the act. The apartment's over 40 years old, and there's 4 broken seams, and he puts the manufacturing requirements, just shoots them with metal screws and doesn't stop any of the leaking in the flue pipes. The next day that the code enforcement comes in, even though there's 3% here, the code enforcement man just turns the furnace on for a very short period of time, gets his error, and says everything is okay because he didn't go behind Calvin Morris to check what was going on in the repairs up in the attic. He's there for a very short period of time instead of like a professional would do is run this furnace for 3 hours and take continuous readings. He just walks in, takes a reading of the floor, says okay, put the place back in service. This problem was not corrected, and it continued to spew CO into the attic. The jury inferred, as they well should have, that this problem was an old flue pipes. They were there from the time this place was built, and this is the status. They broke the flue pipes at the time of movement, but the furnace wasn't used largely until October. All the occupants continue to get worse and worse as they continue to live in the apartment. And on January 4th, 13, the alarm was off again. It's just as an alarm to get out because you have deadly gas. You have to evacuate. So they're living with this defect has not been fixed in the ceiling, and with what our evidence shows is that the crack in the shape.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, counsel, but may I ask you another question about the legal standard? Sorry, Chief, I'm at the...
No, that's quite right. Go ahead.
A very brief question, should be a very brief answer, one way or the other. In federal court, across the board, based upon Rule 37E and the advisory commentary to that, there has to be a showing of a party's intentional loss or destruction of evidence to prevent its use in litigation. Absent a showing of that, as I understand federal law and the law of many states, you can't get an adverse inference. Are you disputing that, or are you saying that you have enough evidence that that intentionality was shown?
In this case, my position is you could infer intentionality, but it's an issue that's not resolved in the state of Virginia. That is the issue you have to have. You have to show bad faith versus circumstances that you either could infer intentionality or show something.
Very fair. Thank you very much. You've answered my question.
And your time is expired. Your time is expired. Mr. Casey, you're not required to have that up there if you don't want it. But since he used it, if you want to use it, you may.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I don't plan to use it.
All right. You can take it down if you want. All right. Go right in.
Thank you. The blue pipe in the November incident, the blue pipe was repaired by Calvin Morris, Danny Carlson of the City of Virginia Beach Code Inspection, with Mr. Morris, used a detector for carbon monoxide, tested the furnace running after the blue pipe was repaired, and they found that ultimately zero parts per million of carbon monoxide, and therefore Mr. Carlson of the city concluded that Morris's repair of the blue pipe had solved the problem and gave permission to Emerald Point to take the red tag off and to continue using
it. Well, now, was that the day that they came back and said you shouldn't have put the screws in the flue pipe?
The plant's expert testified that you shouldn't put screws in the flue pipe, but there was no testimony that putting screws in the flue pipe caused any of the leaks. It didn't have anything to do with the leaks. The screws in the flue pipe were there both when...
But it's not accurate to say it was fixed, is it?
Yes, because they tested it. And they found zero parts per million of carbon monoxide after that was done. And in fact, plaintiff's expert, Mr. White, who's the one who says putting screws in is not the thing to do, he didn't find any carbon monoxide either. So whether or not putting screws in the blue pipe was the best practice of repairing it or not, we know that it fixed the problem. And the carbon monoxide leak was fixed as a result of that.
But during that time period, there was also a tag on the furnace itself that said possible cracked liner, ?
Right. And that was because that was a question mark, exactly. Possible cracked heat exchanger. And what we know is that nobody inspected the heat exchanger until after the furnace was removed in January when the furnace was taken out. And that's the first time that the heat exchanger was inspected and found not to be a problem.
But it wasn't inspected by the plaintiff's people.
It was not, but it was there. The plaintiff's expert came out to the and inspected the flue pipes and photographed the flue pipes in the attic and photographed and inspected the apartment. And the whole time that Mr. White was there photographing the flue pipes and inspecting the flue pipes, the furnace was there to be inspected. He never asked to inspect it.
Well, we know that there was CO in the apartment, though.
Not at that time. This is after the old furnace had been taken out and the new furnace was installed. And the fire department passed the apartment, as you said, and the furnace expert came out and did an inspection, but didn't ask to inspect the furnace, didn't request to inspect the furnace at all, only inspected the flue pipes in the attic, but never asked for the furnace. In fact, there's nothing in the record that plaintiffs ever requested.
Where was the furnace at that particular moment in time?
It was in the maintenance bay at on-premises.
So it was right there.
It was right there. There is not a single part of the record where the plaintiff asked to inspect the furnace.
The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.